Thank you for downloading One to One from BBC Radio 4.
I knew I was meant to be a journalist pretty much from the moment I covered my first news story. If you like, it was my Damascene moment. I had a hunch, it proved to be correct, even though everybody else was telling me a very different story, and I knew from that moment that this was what I was meant to be. In this series of interviews for One to One, I'm speaking to three people to find out what exactly drove them to pursue what for them is both a career and a passion. Was there an epiphany, something in their very core, or maybe a series of events that motivated them? Professor Ian Hutchison is a world-renowned facial surgeon. He works at St Bartholomew's Hospital in London and set up and runs Saving Faces, a charity based at Barts, which conducts research into the prevention and treatment of facial diseases and injuries. I'm here at St Barts, and we're surrounded by artwork of people's faces before and after some really radical surgery. And that's what you do, isn't it? You put people's faces back together.
I try, yes.
Mm. What was young Ian like?
Young Ian was a competitive swimmer, a water polo player, interested in girls, not really an ardent student, bumbled through and managed to come out with a dental degree by the age of early 20s, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you sort of present yourself as if you were a little bit laissez-faire, but, I mean, to be on all those teams, there was a driven quality about you, I would have thought.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I trained all the time. I trained three times a day from the age of 11 to 16 as a swimmer, and then during my university career, and because I did two undergraduate degrees, I was able to train every evening for the water polo team and played at World Student Games and things like that.
So I wonder, that is interesting, because if you were so driven and you knew what made you feel good, that didn't reflect in what you wanted to do for the rest of your life. Where was the disconnect between the two Ians?
Well, I thought I wanted to be a GP because my mother had been a GP and we lived above the surgery, and I loved seeing her being embedded in the community, being a very important part of the community, and I thought that's what I wanted to be. But because I did dentistry first, I was never going to be a GP.
You are unusual because some people have a Damascene moment. It seems to me you've sort of had three in your life. And the first did occur when you were doing this dentistry stint.
What happened was I did a year at Brighton with a wonderful consultant, and he let me do lots and lots of stuff. And what I did was the casualty department was very busy, and they were very happy to have a willing pair of hands down there. And so I'd go down at about 10 o'clock at night, and I'd say, is there anybody in that needs treatment with a facial injury? And I ended up treating all the facial lacerations, all the cuts that people had. And in those years, this is the early 1970s, there were no seatbelt laws, there were no drink driving laws, there were shattered glass windscreens, not shatterproof windscreens. So at about 11 o'clock at night, we'd have a whole troop of young people, 18 and 19-year-olds, having crashed their car. Their face was mottled with cuts, with bits of glass in. They were a bit drunk. And what I'd do is I'd take them off into a quiet room, I'd put local anaesthetic in, not put them off to sleep, and they'd go off to sleep because of the alcohol on board and they weren't feeling any pain. And I'd pick out the bits of glass and I'd just calmly and quietly and methodically put the jigsaw puzzle back together of all the little cuts. And so what, for me, and I didn't realise it at the time because I was so absorbed by the process of doing it, that I didn't realise that the reason that I really, really enjoyed doing it was the emotional transformation of the patient from horror, the end of my life as I know it, back to relative normality.
Mm.
And that is why I realise now that I love doing the surgery that I do. So I went off to medical school and was working part-time during the holidays to maintain what skills I had learnt so that I was ready to re-enter the field of oral and maxillofacial surgery at the end of medicine.
When you did re-enter the field, I presume the cases that you were presented with were even more challenging than those that you've described already.
I thought that what I wanted to do was treat people with hideous disfigurement. But on the way, while I was doing my general surgery training, because you have to do that as well, I worked at the Royal Marsden Hospital, and in 1983 we were doing the first microvascular reconstructions of people's faces. And I loved the technique and the surgery, and so I changed my mind in the 80s from doing hideous facial disfigurement to do cancer. Mm-hmm. And cancer is what I mainly do now, removing cancers and reconstructing people.
On the way to that realisation, were there certain cases that have lived with you all the time, that defined you in a way?
Well, there's a case that I remember vividly from the stitching period, which was of a young boy. He was 11 years old. He was out with his family for a celebratory event. The car turned over. He managed to climb out of the car and knocked on a farmer's house and managed to call the ambulance. When he arrived in the hospital, it was clear that he'd been scalped. He had a cut running over the top of his head, and half his scalp was hanging down over his eye and his ear. He came in, and under local anaesthetic and a little bit of sedative, he was stitched up. Nothing particularly skillful other than care and attention. And his family were thrilled that he was restored to them like this.
There aren't many parallels between our careers. I mean, what you do is so incredibly worthwhile, and I chat to people. I have a very lucky job where I can talk to people like you. But there is one similarity, and which I think is interesting, and where you break the rules. In both of our professions, supposedly we are not meant to get involved. You're not like that, though. You've ripped all that up, and you do get deeply emotionally involved.
I remember my patients. I do get deeply involved. I'd like to tell you another story. It's about being called to casualty for an 11 or 12-year-old girl who is pouring blood from her ears and her nose and her mouth after she was hit by a car. And she's there, the other surgeons around, and they've called me down because they're saying, try and stop the bleeding. And her parents are there. And they're watching this whole process of trying to save the life of their daughter. And I think it was very important for the parents to be there. But for me, I tied off her jugular vein, I tied off her carotid artery on one side, she carried on bleeding, and we weren't able to save her, and she died in front of her parents, and the parents were saying, isn't there anything more you can do? Isn't there anything more you can do? And, you know, these are really important moments in people's lives. Should the parents have been there? I think they should have been there, because it's the last few moments of...
You are, I mean, this is radio, but you are... You're on the verge of tears just telling me this story.
Because you can't help but get affected by these things. That brings me on to my second Damascene moment, which is my daughter wanted to do work experience with me. She thought that she'd enjoy, she'd help her friends when they'd had cuts, and she'd pressed on the wounds when her other friends were fainting. She felt this was something that she'd enjoy doing. And what happened was that she told me afterwards what she loved most was sitting in my clinic. And she loved it best when I was called in to see a patient in another room, and she spent time talking to the patients. And that was when I realised that actually what I love best is getting to know my patients. If you're a successful cancer surgeon, then your patients carry on living, and you see them once a year. You've been with the patient and their family at the most dramatic moment in their lives. I like the patients to know about my life, and I like to know about their life, what's happening in their life. And it's lovely seeing my patients again, hugging them, kissing them, and finding out what's going on in their lives. And that's what gives me the greatest joy.
You talk about family, and your lines are kind of, I guess, blurred, deliberately blurred, between your professional life and your emotional life. And you're married to Helena Kennedy, a very passionate lawyer. I just wonder then, when you are at home trying to create a home life, how much of your, both of your professional lives sort of leak into that space, and what effect does that have on a marriage, if you like?
Well, Helena and the kids aren't that fussy about knowing about what I do physically during the day. My wife thinks it's revolting, and she loves the fact that I have this relationship with people, just as she has the relationship with her clients that she defends. She forms those very strong bonds. So we're both the same, as you pointed out, but Helena's stories are more translatable to everyday life than my stories. So people don't really want to hear about the stories of what I do during my working day.
Staying in that family space for a moment longer, I mean, my husband is passionate about his work. I love what I do. We sort of almost, I suppose, subliminally have a moratorium on how much we can talk about what happened in our day. And then we do something completely ludicrous. We like watching comedy on the television. Just something so neutral in the space between us. Do you have that sort of moment yourself? Because you talk so much about what you do, and you love what you do so much. Where is the space beyond it?
Well, I didn't have a father. My mother brought me up on her own. And I loved being a father. And so I've had a very, very physical relationship with all my children. I hug and kiss them. I still hug and kiss my 30-year-old son when I see him every evening. He hugs and kisses me. We spend a lot of time being very physical with each other. I listen when I go home a lot. I listen to their problems and the children's problems, even Helena's problems, and try to work out how to solve them. And we go to the pictures. We do everyday things at home, but there's a lot of physical stuff, wrestling, hugging, kissing, you know,
I guess they're quite strapping lads now, the wrestling.
They're very gentle with me now.
So with the future, I mean, you have such enormous ambitions for the field. Just tell me a little bit about the way you want it to develop.
My third revelatory moment was when I listened to Mike Baum, who's a professor of surgical oncology, talking about breast cancer research. The Patey radical mastectomy was an example of how the god who was Patey, a British surgeon, could define how patients should be treated with breast cancer. The only proper way to treat them was by doing a radical mastectomy, with taking out all the lymph glands in the axilla. People like Mike Baum were people who were saying, hang on a moment, what about if we just took out the lump and took out a couple of glands to see if they're involved? And they were ridiculed. They were vilified. You're killing patients. What they found, of course, as we know now, was that lumpectomy was every bit as good as radical mastectomy, and the quality of life of patients was so much better after it. So I now understand that we have facts, but we make all sorts of assumptions. And we have conditions where there are maybe 8 different treatments for the same condition. And each surgeon says the treatment they're following is the right one and the treatment the other surgeons are following is wrong. We want to try and compare those treatments, and very rarely have they been compared in any of the common condition like hernia or varicose veins and so on. It's very important to know that, because the treatments may be better in somebody who's a 65-year-old surgeon or an 18-year-old athlete. Or one treatment may always be better than the other. Or one treatment for cancer, for instance, may involve a 12-hour operation and give a 90% chance of cure. But a half-hour operation gives an 80% chance of cure. So the patients would say, OK, I'd much rather have the half-hour operation, even though I know I've only got an 80% chance of cure. It gives patients a chance to make a choice. We can't give them that information. So what Saving Faces has set up is to create the National Facial and Oral Research Centre, which is the first of its kind in the world. The United Kingdom will be leading the world in determining the evidence base for best treatment practice in all facial surgery. And we'll do that by collecting the data on 5 million patients a year who have facial surgery here in the United Kingdom, around the world, including Europe. So my mission started with stitching and emotional transformation, continues with understanding that what I'm doing this for is because I'm embedded in people's lives at the most traumatic moment. But now, let's make treatment better for every patient worldwide. Find out what the best treatment is now, innovate to see how we can make it even better.
Professor Ian Hutchison, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Anita.